Ezra German, reel 3.
The house where I lived, number 56, Lugia Siela, or otherwise, 3 Leipziger Straße, if that's 3 or 5, Sachsenhaus, 3R, 3R, yes.
Just wait there, Ezra, start closing the gateway. Okay, carry on. And if you pick it up from 3 Leipziger Straße.
Sachsenhaus 3R, Leipziger Straße. In Latvian days, this was 52 Lutzersjela, or Lutzersjela. This was behind the Kommandantur, the house in front, was the Kommandantur of the ghetto, where Obersturmführer Krause held court, and his sidekick, Oberscharführer Gimlich, or Gimlich, I never found out whether it was Lich or Nich, and various others, Migge, and the Jewish administration was there as well. The ghetto älteste, Max Israel Leiser, Herr und Frau Fromm, the Royal Commander, all that happened there. And for instance, the day they shot the Latvian Jewish police, which was on the 31st of October, 1942, they were made to stand in ranks around the wall of the Kommandantur yard, right in front of my window, and were later on marched to the central place, the Blechplatz, the Tin Square, in the center of the ghetto, and where they were shot, accused of having harbored weapons that planned an uprising, and they had helped others to escape. It was apparently betrayed, and they were shot. I heard the machine gun fire. Machine pistol fire. Still have it ringing in my ears. Otherwise, brutality. I can't even particularly single out incidents at that moment because I think it would be wrong to say it was the order of the day in the ghetto as such. But it didn't surprise anybody if one came across it. What was much more an everyday business was hanging. I went begging that winter we first arrived, begging for bread. And I went begging for bread among those groups in German, from Germany who had come before us, who, as I had explained earlier, had already found their feet. And we were settled in the ghetto according to where we came from. The first furthest removed was group Cologne, Köln. Then came Düsseldorf, Bielefeld, with Münster, and then came Hanover. And I went begging particularly to the group Hanover, simply because I had an uncle in the community who worked in the Jewish community building in Hanover, and thereby I could hope that my name would be familiar to some people from Hanover, which it was, and therefore I was already to some degree halfway there being a known quantity to them, and they might pass with a piece of bread more readily. It worked once or twice. It was a bit of infant psychology, but it did work once or twice. But of course they had nothing to give themselves. But the point I'm mentioning this is because on the way to Hanover, the group Hanover, I walked past the gallows, and it was nothing rare to see a body swinging there, or several bodies. The gallows were around the corner from the Blechplatz, in front of the bunker, the prison.
This must have taken its toll on your mother, Ezra. How did she cope?
I still marvel when I think of my mother. The first thing she did when we got into those quarters we had been designated, where we lived with other people, was to get a bucket of water and scrub the floor. I still remember this. It wasn't clean enough for her. So she got down and cleaned up the kitchen. Now, this wasn't just a kitchen. We lived in that kitchen as well. We had one room and a kitchen. That kitchen was shared between 12 people. The kitchen was about 7 by 8 meters. About 5 meters by three. Possibly 3.5. And, my mother just coped. I don't know how she did it. She looked after us, obviously. She cooked. Other people who went already to work outside the ghetto and therefore had access to food and brought it into the ghetto, she rendered them services for food. She scrounged around wherever she could. And she did manage to get bits extra. Not a lot. I mean, we were still starving. But we were no longer living entirely on the rations. And as soon as she could, she went out to work. She waited for the severe cold to be over. And then she went out. Because she felt she couldn't leave us in the severe cold. Because we had no heating. I mean, we lived in unheated premises. Once in a while, yes, when the food was cooked, which was another reason why my mother had sorted out the kitchen for us to live in, because we were warmer that way. People did cook. I myself once or twice went to the uninhabited part of the Riga ghetto. There were quite a large area where there were no longer any Jews left to live in it, because the Latvian Jews who'd lived there had been killed off. And we used to chop up furniture there and bring the furniture back, the wood, to burn it. Also in the cellars of the houses, we found logs that had been left. So,
what skills did you learn in the ghetto that stood you in good stead later on?
Sorry? What skills?
Just 3 minutes left. I think it might change. Mm-hmm. Yes. Just going to change the... Okay, Andrew.
Well, at no point... At no point did I think we were going to be killed. But at the back of my mind, I knew very well that that was strictly on the cards. I knew that. I think we all knew it, but we never talked about it. We did know that there was a lorry that came periodically to the ghetto, which had a gas chamber mounted at the back. It was one of those lorries that the Germans used first, whereby the exhaust gases were conducted into the lorry's interior, which was hermetically sealed. We knew of this. I never saw it, but people tell me who were there with me that they saw it and they knew all about it. I certainly heard it being talked about and referred to. Old people and children were singled out one day in the winter of 42 and were taken away to what they called Dünamünde to work in a Konservenfabrik, i.e. A factory for tinned goods, food processing. And of course they never arrived, they were never heard of again. Whether they arrived or not, we didn't know, of course, but Latvian Jews told us that there was no such place called Dünamünde. It didn't exist. I have since learned, and I've heard it time and again, also in my later travels in Germany and in the GDR, you can know a thing and you can hide that knowledge from yourself quite successfully. So, in a way you do know, and in a different way you don't know. And I think this has certainly happened to me in the... Well, all the time I was in camp. Oddly enough, I never felt that I would die, or that I would be killed. I don't know why. But
about the liquidation of the ghetto.
Just before we start, can we just quiet down?
Yes.
Just have it open.
Yes. We'll keep it open. Yes.
So we did know that death was always around the corner, but somehow, I understand it's the same for people in wartime. You never think it's necessarily there for you. In any case, I was a child and I was fascinated by all these new things going on around me. I was in a strange country. Across, sometimes from the barbed wire, I got a glimpse of the shops across the road on the other side of the barbed wire, with their strange inscriptions, Particas Preciu Tirgotava, for instance. Preciu was often seen, that must mean a shop or something. Tirgotava was another one. Seeing inscriptions of Latvian, Dvornik, Stingu Aizlieks, learning a few words of Latvian, a few words of Russian. I was eager to learn Russian because I knew when liberation came it would be the Russians. Obviously, in that part of the world it had to be. And so life went on. I left school. I was sent to work in the police nursery where we grew vegetables for the police, the Jewish ghetto police. In the Latvian ghetto. That meant that I had access to the Latvian ghetto. My mother worked at that point already in a magazine, in a depot where they stored potatoes for the Wehrmacht. And as luck would have it, she met there a German soldier who was a friend of a very good friend of ours in Germany. And this friend, he got in touch with this friend of ours in Germany. This friend of ours sent parcels to him and he gave them to my mother. So again we had help. This was, of course, strictly would have meant death for him, for the people in Germany, and for all of us. There were one or two people who were taken away and never seen or heard of again, and rumor had it that they had tried to establish contact with people back home. The important bit was that I was sent to work in this nursery and I learned how to be a gardener and various other tricks of the trade, such as how to deal with a fuse, rudimentary electrician's work, a bit of plumbing, that came later. And just as we were nicely settled in and had made our peace with the ghetto and learned how to survive in it, it was liquidated. That was, our turn came in October 43. My mother had seen to it that she and us were to be sent away together. Kazaniert, as it was called. We were going to be whatever you like to call it. We were going to be sent to a camp, the same camp. They wouldn't be separated. She'd bribed somebody. Bribery was fairly rife. And she could bribe by then because she could bring potatoes in the ghetto. And from her potato job later on, she graduated to some other provision store for the Wehrmacht where she had access to tinned, sweetened milk and various other comestibles. So we no longer starved, although it was still under punishment of death. Now, the ghetto was little by little, it was liquidated, the inhabitants were taken away. And we were taken away on the 31st of October, 1943. Once again, we mounted a lorry, once again with one suitcase or whatever, not even that. And we were still wearing civilian clothes in those days. And we were wearing the Star of David, the Judenstern. The Latvian Jews wore it chest and back, back and front, and we only wore it in front, the Germans. So-called German Jews. And once again, one was on a lorry, as I had been before once or twice when I had visited Riga to work for some working detail that worked in the town. And we drove through Riga and out of Riga, along, and then finally we were told to disembark, to get off that lorry, in the yard, front yard of a large factory building. The factory was surrounded by a very high wall on all sides, and on one side where it was open, it was the lake, Lake Jukla. In German it was called Jägersee. And there we were. And there we had the real brutality from the word go. The Lagerälteste, I didn't know he was that, a man called Hans Brun, a non-Jewish prisoner, but a prisoner, not SS. Started beating people with sticks. What happened was we were lined up, this was a ritual we were to get to know. The moment you come into a camp, you line up for search, body search. You are told to put everything that you have on you in pockets or whatever in front of you. You are then told to go away and of course all the stuff you never see again. If you have hidden something and they search you and you get caught at it, they do spot checks, then they beat you up, fairly brutally. And that is what happened that evening. Unbeknownst to me, my mother had smuggled some silk stockings, which were a very desirable article for barter, in the lining off the coat I was wearing. It was a sort of the precursor of the anorak, a short winter coat, which I'd bought from Germany. Very handy garment. And we got through that search, and then the starvation started all over again. This factory building had been either British or American-owned spinning mill before the war, which made cotton thread and similar. And the machines had been taken out and thrown out of most of the building, not all of it. Tables put up with sewing machines, and this is where we were now to repair German army uniforms. October 43. That is the beginning of the winter of Stalingrad. And Stalingrad, of course, was a watershed in the war. And we got the uniforms from Stalingrad in the Russian front, bloodstained. I'm told some still had limbs in it. I don't know how true this could be, but this is what I was told. My mother worked at a sewing machine. And immediately set to using lining from German army uniforms and the thicker outer cloth for soles to make slippers, bedroom slippers. Latvia as such didn't suffer any hardship at that time. The country is so rich in food, there was this plenty. I don't even think they were rationed, Latvians, I'm not sure. So, my mother made these slippers, surreptitiously, obviously, on the QT. She had to be very careful. And there were three blocks in the building where we were housed. They were called blocks. They were one floor each. Block 1, 2, 3, 4. Block 4 were girls from Kovno and Vilna. Block 3 was also Vilna, other parts of Poland, but mainly from Germany. Block 2 were us from the ghetto, and Block 1 were those men who had come, mostly Latvian Jews, but some Germans as well, who had come before us to set the camp up. They had come quite a while before us. They had come already in August or July. We didn't get down till October. So my mother made slippers, and she gave them to some of the girls from Block 4, who worked together somewhere where they could get in touch with Latvian civilians, i.e. non-Jews, non-prisoners, and bartered them, because manufactured articles were scarce. And the girl would take a cut, and the rest would go to my mother. And so again, we did have some extra food, and that was sorely needed, because now we couldn't cook ourselves. The ability to cook didn't exist, except for me at a later date, and an earlier date, but I was privileged to have access to it. And we had to eat what we were given. And the soup that we got twice a day was nothing but hot water, but really only hot water, nothing but. It was colored blue, strangely enough, because we were supposed to have blue peas in it. Yes, that is very strange. Latvia has a kind of pea variety that is blue and cooks blue. Very tasty. But, of course, we never had any of those in the soup, or at most one, or half of one. The soup was colored blue. Sometimes it was made of oats, but again, there was hardly any oats in it. Sometimes, once in a while, you'd find a shred of horse flesh, but very rarely. So you couldn't really live on the rations. You got your usual slice of bread and horse fat once or twice a week. That was it. Finished. And to try and get horse fat to spread in the winter is not easy. Now, however, one was glad if one had it. And I was apprenticed at first to help a man to become a sewing machine mechanic. But in February, I could see which way the wind was blowing, and I volunteered to go to the field down by the lake, which I knew was there. We weren't allowed to go there, but once in a while we had to go. We could go near it. You'll see it from afar. And offered to start a garden. And they were looking for volunteers to do precisely this, and I was given the job. I was too young, so I was given a foreman over me, and I myself. and the two of us set out with pickaxes and spades to dig the first cold frame. The SS administration saw to it that we got fresh horse manure. People still used horses in those days. And so it wasn't difficult to come by. And some good soil, which we sieved, and we hacked open the ground, surrounded, made a wall out of bricks, put a couple of factory windows on top for the glazing, put horse manure under the topsoil to warm it through. First we let it rot, of course. We used, it's got to rot down well. And there we had our first seed bed. And that meant that in summer, when the field was producing produce for the SS, I also had food. I could steal from their food, which I did. It also saved my life. Because being a gardener, I had to undergo another camp ritual, which is roughing up the newcomer, rough. When you came into a new camp, or when you got a job that exposed you to the attention of the guards, the SS, or whoever, of the hierarchy, you first of all got beaten up. That was routine. So I was to work in the garden. Some people thought I was crazy to volunteer to go out in the cold winter, it was still February, and to leave the heated tailoring workshop, which had to be heated, otherwise people couldn't work, to go out in the cold. But I thought spring won't be that far behind, and there will be as gardening, there's produce. Where there's produce, I can steal. Because by that time, stealing had become a part of life. You stole whatever you could. And as soon as I appeared, of course, near the garden, I was subject to the next ritual, which is roughing up the newcomer. As soon as you somehow stood out and were on your own, vis-a-vis the SS, guards, whoever, the hierarchy, you got a beating. In my case, they were a little more reticent because I was still a child. But one day when the Lager Älteste, this aforementioned Hans Brun, who was probably the most brutal person I met during the entire camp existence, when I had aroused his displeasure, he let me have it. And my face showed it. That too had its positive, because when I went to the SS kitchen to collect the potato peelings for my compost heap, a Polish prisoner, non-Jewish, noticed that Hans had beaten me up, and he went for him and berated him. And then he said, "Wait," in his broken German, went and brought me bread and sausage and said, "Come back tomorrow. From now on, you'll get breakfast every day." There you are. Fellow prisoner, non-Jewish, Polish, fellow, could hardly speak German. So, see. Anyway. It also meant that I had the potato peelings, which, of course, didn't end up in the compost. I cooked them. Now, how did I cook them? The yarn from the spinning mill went onto cotton reels. These cotton reels were made of wood, and these wooden reels were cut on lathes. Yeah, not individually, machine cut, I suppose they were capstans or whatever. They cut out those cotton reels. And after they were cut, they went into a drying chamber. And that drying chamber had central heating. And the exhaust of the steam was led to the outside through a pipe. And I used to shove the potato peelings in a tin which I found somewhere, fill it with water, put it under the pipe so that the steam had to go through the water in which the potato peels were. And that cooked them. Would you believe it? It does work. You can cook potatoes that way. I've done it. So that was again a privilege. Little by little, however, of course, I didn't need this anymore so much because there was produce. There was garden produce. And you can't control the number of radishes. So we did rather better. And where it saved my life was that on the, oh, I forget, it must have been August, or no, July, 1944. No, what am I talking about? 43, July 43. There was a search in the camp and there was a selection. And they sorted out children and old people. And they were taken away. But on this day, particularly, it was children only. Well, they didn't see me because I was working in the field. But I came in for the lunchtime, for the soup. And one of the SS, I was told later, Hauptscharführer Meisels from Kaiserwald, he spotted me. And he asked me how old was I. I said, 15. He said, we'll see about that. Motioned the guard to take me away. And the guard did precisely that, and we fetched up near a room that was locked. I could hear the children screaming from inside because they knew, or they had an idea what their fate might be. And I couldn't think straight at all. I was quite cool, but very, as if I lived in a different dimension. And at that point, I was just going to be locked into that room with the others. They hadn't opened the door to it yet when the commandant of the camp came out of his door. Now, I knew the commandant. He had been a very brutal, that was another camp metamorphosis. Quite often an SS man and someone in power would start out as a really brutal so-and-so, a real beast. And little by little, through contact with us or a girlfriend or people, he'd become more civilized. And then he wouldn't be brutal anymore. Also, of course, be it noted, at that point many people could begin to see that Germany was going to lose the war, which may have been another ingredient. I'm now talking about the summer of 1943, post-Stalingrad, post-Alamein. The commandant came out of his house, and I ran towards him, and I said, this bloke wants to take me away. Der Kerl will mich mitnehmen. And he said, well, we won't let him. He went up, and the other one, the one who tried to take me away, was a superior officer who had approached in the meantime. And he stood to attention, the commandant, and told him that I was a good worker, and the gardener was above 15, out over 15 anyway. So he motioned me to disappear, which I did, pronto. I couldn't help the other kids. I tried to tell them, I shouted, you know, calm, the commandant is here, because by that time we actually had some confidence, the commandant. But the commandant more or less told me to shut up and get away. Obviously it was a stupid thing for me to do, to give him a good write-up in the presence of his superior. Good write-up from our point of view. So I got away. And I just made it back to barracks, to that block, when there were the kids standing around, not the kids, men, who had worked with, who knew me, wondering how to break the news to my mother that I'd been taken. Well, in the event, they didn't have to. But the mothers whose children had been taken, I went to the workshops afterwards to visit my mother. I shall never forget that. If you really want to be haunted to the end of your days, it is a mother whose child has been taken away. And I won't dwell on it. Now, and
did you know what was happening to people who were selected and taken away to raise?
No.
Tell us about what happened to
you. We never heard of again. And now this was the first, then there was another selection where they selected people over 50. And my mother was under 50. She was in her late 30s, early 40s, something like that. Early 40s. So we survived that. But then after that, there was another selection where they took everyone over 35. And then my mother was selected. And one day we knew that she was on the list. No, we didn't. No, we didn't. It was just one morning, we were standing at roll call. You always had roll call every morning. When Unterscharführer Schumann from Vienna, it's amazing how many Austrians there were among the SS. Got up and started reading out a list. And my mother was on it. And she had to stand up, come out, and, well, the woman's block was separate anyway. So I was allowed to walk over to her and say goodbye to her, and so was my brother. My mother was in tears. The commandant was standing next to us. He'd come over, because by that time he had taken quite a shine to me. I was his protégé. And he said, of course, the younger boy, meaning me, can go with you, but the older boy has to stay here. That would be my brother. And my mother said, I would rather the younger boy also stayed here with you. And the commandant said, yes, I think it is better that he does. And that was that. Then he motioned us to go away, my brother and me. Or we went anyway. We didn't want to make it more difficult for my mother. Yeah. So made our goodbyes. I don't know what form they took. I couldn't tell you. Because that day, again, was so supercharged that you go through it as if you are in a haze. Half of you isn't there. You act in a way as if you were a robot, an automaton. And the other half of you is there and observes it at one remove, but not everything. And so the people that were selected were loaded in the lorry and they left. And that was that. And I laughed like a train. I don't think I have ever laughed quite so much in my life. That day, the commandant's hairdresser, my brother, the camp electrician, Heinz Simon from Bielefeld, myself, we were pals. At that point, the camp atmosphere was very much relaxed. It was, or it had become more relaxed, for whatever reason it was.
Session number 19790, Ezra German, Reel 4.